And I couldn't see why we couldn't do that. Now, that was one of the disagreements. The fact is that the project was being terminated anyhow by the national, the Army Medical Library. They weren't going to renew the contract. And the net effect of that was that I was done out of my vacation. And we parted. He was hostile to me until the very end. Never had a pleasant word to say to me until he died. And in fact, after I left Hopkins, Larky was very weird about publishing. I could never get him to agree that something was ready for publication. So when I left, I submitted several manuscripts that I had written for publication. In one case, a paper that I eventually got published in the Journal of Documentation, he actually got the university attorney after me to try and prevent my publishing this paper, an innocuous paper on the preparation of subject heading lists by punch card methods, which certainly did not turn out to be a classic, but there it is. It was one of my first papers ever published. And I had to, so all of my contact with Mr. Adair came after I left the Welch Project. I went up to Columbia University. A couple of my friends had advised me that if I wanted to stay in the field, it would be a good idea if I got a library degree, because I had been mixing with all these librarians, but I didn't have a professional qualification. So I went to Columbia Library School during the summer, and I don't remember how I scrounged up the money to pay for the summer session, but I did. I went there for the summer session. And I found out that, you know, I could get a master's degree in 1 year. And luckily, Dean Carl White had seen, observed me, and told me about the Grolier Society Fellowship, which was sponsored by the Encyclopedia Americana. I applied for this fellowship, and I got it. And the reason that I got it, when they asked for my references, I gave them as references the director of the National Agricultural Library, the director of the Army Medical Library, and the chief assistant librarian of Congress, Berta Clapp.
Who all knew me from the previous project.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And Ralph Shaw was one of the people. And Brad Rogers.
Getting that fellowship was obviously...
Oh, it made the difference because I couldn't afford it.
But weren't you, before that, weren't you getting a little discouraged?
Well, at that point, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had been told by people, the National Science Foundation, several years, why didn't I apply for a grant? Well, they weren't giving grants to unaffiliated individuals. And it's a lot of nonsense. I still resent that. Why should you have to be affiliated with a university in order to be able to qualify to get a grant? But it's all part of this bureaucratic notion that people steal. I mean, if you're an individual and you got a $5,000 grant, let's say, God knows what you do with the money. Spend it to eat. So, I did get that fellowship, and I graduated. I think I was the top student of the class. But before I had graduated, during that year, is when I published my major paper on citation indexing.
This was the science.
In science, yeah. I submitted it during the year that I also submitted a paper. I became friendly with Adair. I was an editor, I was the youngest editor of American Documentation. Jesse Shearer knew me and asked me to become an editor. I must say that was quite a...
that's a Adair's pretty easy when he refers to...
Yeah, and I was the one who suggested to Adair to write this article as editor of American Documentation. And after he wrote this paper, then I said I would do my other paper.
That itself was an American Documentation was a new journal.
Well, relatively, it was the journal of the American Documentation Institute. But the American Documentation Institute had just become, quite recently, in fact, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of ACES now, but it wasn't always an individual membership group. The year I joined was the first year you could join as an individual. So that's how he did this. And a year later, the summer of 1955, I drove out there with my son to visit Mr. Adair in Colorado Springs. And so I got this thing published, and I got my paper in Science published in 55, but I did all the work while I was at Columbia. And 53 to 54 is when I did that. Now, while I was at Columbia, I had decided to continue my doctoral work in the field of mechanical translation. Because all during that time I followed that field, and a very close friend of mine, Casimir Borkowski, was working with Leon Doster, who was the leading exponent at the time of mechanical translation at Georgetown University.
Mechanical translation?
Of mechanical translation of Russian,
yes,
and foreign languages. And I was going to come to work down there. Cass Borkowski was already working with us there. By the time, however, I finished my work at Columbia, several things had happened. First of all, I had tried to put together a PhD program. And at Columbia, it was in order to, I didn't want to do it on any subject that was, you know, there were no professors that really understood this field. So you had to put together what they call an interdisciplinary committee. And I got three or four professors to agree to serve on this committee, but I could never get them to meet. I had, one of them was a chemical physicist, Professor Kimball, who was a computer guy. And my topic was going to be machine methods of scientific documentation, you know, the application of computers. And I couldn't swing it. I couldn't get them to do it. In the meantime, I got a call from Ted Hertigan at Smith, Kline & French. And he had met me down at the Welch Project. And just about that time was when Thorazine had really burst on the scene, and Smith Kline was just inundated with information that they had to have processed. Ted said to me, come on, why don't you come down? He was a really sweet man, and Ted convinced me to come down and work for them temporarily for 6 months. And he said, you could earn a little money, and after your 6 months, then you could go back to Georgetown University, continue your work, and so forth. So I came down here in the summer of 54. Okay. And I guess the reason for the discrepancies in these dates is the time lags in the submissions. You know, it took a hell of a long time to get papers published in those days. Because my paper in Science, interestingly enough, the person who helped me most in editing that paper, even though it didn't get published until 55, I think, was H. Bentley Glass, who was a professor of genetics at Johns Hopkins. But he was one of the editors of Science, I think, or something like that, or the referee or whatever. And he went over the manuscript and really helped improve it. And eventually it got it published, because it was a hit and miss as to whether it would get published. So Ted convinced me to come down, and I was desperate, you know, for money by that time, and I had to make a decision. So I came down and worked for Smith Kline. That's how I got down here. But while I was at Columbia, there was a number of things that I worked on. I worked on the idea of an encyclopedia. I did a term paper on that. And that's the origin for the Atlas Encyclopedia. I really wanted to do a different kind of encyclopedia as well. During that time, I also did the paper on using citation indexes for patents. And I published a paper in the Journal of Patent Office Society, which came about the same time. And I had several of the students help me. One was a student, Marge Corrine, from Merck. She's still, I think, still with Merck, but in one of the different parts of the company. I continued to publish contents in advance, even in library schools, with the help of Ann McCann and some other library school students.
What was the circulation of that, and who was it going to?
It was going to library schools and librarians. You know, it was very small. Even within a year or so, I had to fold it. I mean, it was $6 a year, what it cost, and I couldn't keep it up anymore. I turned it over to the people, Ian McKeon and the others, and let them have it. And I think they tried to publish it for a little while, and they couldn't.
That was in 50?
Yeah, 55. We used to do this size page, and we reduced them down, four contents pages to a page. Most of the library journals were relatively small.
Do any of those
samples exist? Yeah. I don't know. They might. I don't know if we have one here or not. I haven't seen one. I'm sure you could find one in some library catalog somewhere.
How long did the Smith Kline consultant?
Oh, well, so I came to work at Smith Kline, and what happened was that I came down as a consultant, and I was living, working here 4 days a week. And I stayed at the Broadwood Hotel, the place that is now the health club at Broad and Vine. That was the old location of the Broadwood Hotel. So I could walk from Smith Kline down there. I had his room there. And several years later, I was to find out that I was misinformed that I could deduct my travel expenses as a tax deduction, even though I was living in New York, because the Internal Revenue said that my principal residence was Philadelphia. That if you work 4 days a week for a certain period of time, that's where you live. And you kept your apartment in New York for convenience. That's in the end of that. But what happened was that in the winter, November, December of that year, my sister called me and told me that my brother-in-law got berserk, and that I should come and get my son, take him down and live with me, which I did. And that's where Ted Hurrigan, again as a friend, what happened was that I then rented a house across the road from Ted, who lived in Mullican Hill, New Jersey, back 4 miles south of Mullican Hill. I rented a house for $20 a month. It's a three-room house on an asparagus farm. And my son can't deliver me. He was, by then he was 7 years old. And he went to school down in Malacca Hill, Harrison, I forget the name of it, Harrisonville Township. And I drove to work every day with Ted Hertigan. And his sister took care of my son after school. And we lived down there for about a year or more until I got in the summer of 1955. I went out to Colorado to visit Mr. Adair. And on the way back, we stopped in Chicago. And I met my previous girlfriend, who I'd met in 1948, a year after I was divorced, when I was still at Columbia. And we decided to get married. So I then moved to Woodbury, New Jersey for a few months, and then we moved to Thoroughfare, New Jersey, where we had a log cabin, which we rented, a log cabin and a chicken coop. And I converted the chicken coop into my office. All this time I was still a consultant with Smith Kline. She took a job as a secretary at the Franklin Institute. And eventually we had three children. And what happened was that at Smith Kline, they wanted me to work full time, and I made the decision that I wasn't going to be happy working full time for them. But I kept on as a part time consultant for them for several years.
Was that as much as a couple of days a week?
A couple of days a week, yeah. And the rest of the time I had other clients, or basically I began to devote myself more and more. What happened was that I had clients, I did a study for Biological Abstracts. There's a major study for them called Biological Abstracts in an Era of Automation. That was with Miles Conrad, who's now long since dead. And I even did a consulting job for the Encyclopedia Americana. And gradually, what happened somewhere along the line, a friend of mine, Charlotte Studer, subsequently married a man named Mitchell, was the librarian at Miles Laboratories. And they, before that, I had launched. What happened was that I had decided to do a current contents in social and management science. And just as I had announced that, Bell Laboratories heard about it and had been planning to do something similar. So I made a contract with them to produce my publication, which was called Management's Documentation Preview. And I would put a separate cover on 500 copies for them, which they call a Survey of Current Management Literature. And that contract lasted actually for about 8 years. But the year of that contract was a very, very momentous one, because that's how I was introduced to the Household Finance Corporation.
This is 55.
55, I think it is, yeah. Well, let me see. Well, this didn't happen. I got this thing in 1958. I've written this up as an article about how I got my money from her. This is what happened was that I got this contract, but
I had to go to instead of printing these things that I had been doing for the Xerox machine, I had to use a regular printer. I couldn't do such a large quantity that way. And the printer wouldn't give me the material unless I paid him. And I needed, the contract was for twice monthly, I believe. And it was like $15,000 over a year's time. But they wouldn't pay me anything up front. I had to finance the first issue. So I thought this purchase order would be sufficient. I went to the banks. I went to the first in Woodbury, and then I went to banks all over Philadelphia. And they would not advance me any money on that purchase order. They said it was not an account receivable, which is true. And if one put it, you could walk out in the street tomorrow and get hit by a car, and then where would we be? Which I didn't know how to answer it in those days. I don't know why they never heard of insurance, but I was really up against it, and I didn't know what to do. I had gone back a second time to the Woodbury Trust Company, and Mr. Fowler, a very nice man, he said to me, listen, he said, there's no way this bank is going to lend you money. In those days, the interest was 6%, you know, per annum. And he said, but I'll tell you, if you go down the street to Household Finance, they will lend you $500 on your signature. I couldn't believe it. And also, if you grew up in the Depression, finance companies were, it was like you were in the hands of the devil. Okay? And anyhow, I went down there, and sure enough, the guy sat me down. He asked me the usual questions, signed for $500. And I found out some very interesting things about financing, which I had described in an article. But the essence of it was this, that a bank will lend you money at 6% per annum in those days, which is the equivalent of 0.5% per month. But they will make a charge on it, and furthermore, a service charge. And they will also say that you will only be able to you must keep the money for at least a month. You pay for each month. Well, if you're borrowing $500, that means you're paying $10 for the first month, plus the service charge. Let's say it was, $10. That's $20 to borrow $500 for 1 month. Okay. Household Finance charges you 18% per annum, but there is no service charge. 1.5% a month on $500 is $7.50. Okay. Furthermore, if you wanted to, you could return the money in 2 days or 3 days or whatever. I borrowed the $500. I got the stuff printed, and I had to wait about, turned out an agonizingly long time, over a month, I think it was. Bell Labs didn't deliberately do it, but somehow there was a screw-up, and I did not get a check for quite some time. But I went back there to the Household Finance, and I said, here's your money. And he says to me, what are you kidding? He says, you're going to pay me off so soon? I said, what are you talking about? He said, I thought you would be tickled at that, but I paid my debts. So that's not the way we make money. So I said to him, all right, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll pay you this one off. Next time, I'll be back here. And I came back to him because, the expenses started coming in again, and I needed, not only did I need 500, I needed more than 500 because I now was faced with the promotional costs. Right? Because I needed money to promote it. So I said to him, listen, I'm going to borrow this $500 from you, but I said, I'll make a deal with you. How do I get $1,000? He said, $500 is the limit. There's a state limit. I said, Jesus, that's too bad. He said, but you know, and they didn't have computers in those days. He said, that's just this branch. They don't know from one branch to the next what they're doing. So he says, if I give you the name of a guy down in Camden, he says, you can borrow another $500. Well, I started going around. That's how I got this card. And that's how I financed my business. Of course, it got to the point where I didn't need it. But as long as I was not overly ambitious with the borrowing, I was able to manage. That was how I... Now, then there was one period, by the way, where... here's how Current Contents got its name. This management publication with the contract from Bell Ads, I met a public relations man named Harry Brager. Don't ask me how I met him. I think I met him through a printer in Washington. And Harry Brager and this printer came to me and they said, we'll give you $5,000, we'll be partners on this publication with you, and we'll start promoting it as a subscription publication. And he said, this name, Management Documentation Printer, has got to be the worst title ever anyone could ever imagine. And I had to agree. He said, well, you give it some kind of simple name, and we start talking, Current Contents, that's what it is, okay? That's Current Contents. Well, I made this deal with them. They even gave me an office down at Free Thomas Circle in Washington. They then said something which I couldn't believe they were going to do, which was they wanted to take the entire $5,000 and spend it on one mailing. But they were going to bankroll this thing. If this thing really flew, then they put in more, $5,000, $10,000, where they keep on recycling it. The idea being, if you got a 1% response on the subscriptions at $25 a year, which is what it was, 50 subscriptions would be $1,000. And you take that cash and you'd put it into more mailings or whatever. They picked, I couldn't believe, they insisted on using a mailing list consisting of the highest paid individuals in the United States. In other words, anybody with an income over a certain amount of money, they assumed could afford it and would want it. I told you guys have got to be crazy. They insisted on doing this. Well, it bombed. We got a total, I don't know, like we got about 20 subscriptions at most. I'll never forget the first one that came in was from an executive at Allen Wood Steel Company. And the thing bombed, and they backed out, and they said, it's yours. That's how I got the name. Well, I kept on trying. And at one point, we actually discontinued that publication and eventually re-resumed it under the name of Behavioral Social Science. In the meantime, that's when when Miles Labs came along. And she said to me, I'd like to do something for my people with medical journals. So I started doing a Xerox version of the contents page, about 100 journals for her in my chicken coop. And then eventually, when other drug companies bought in, I made a subscription policy that had to buy 25 subscriptions for $1,500 the way I had done it with her. But she bought 100, probably, it was now, some minimum. And that's how it got started. It wasn't until later on that it became a subscription thing where you could buy one copy. And that happened not out of any brilliant design on my part. What happened was that Dr. Jacob Gershon Cohen was a very famous radiologist in Philadelphia. He invented thermography.
Excuse me a second.